Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we are really blessed to have Douglas Riggs with us. And you can go to The Bite Show, go to the audio library, click on Douglas Riggs' name, and his page will open up with all of the audio files that we've worked on. And today, Douglas Riggs is going to talk to us about the veil of spiritual death over the nations. Hi, Douglas.
Hi, Georgianne. It's not a very uplifting title, but it's a reality that we need to recognize.
And, yes.
There's so much suffering going on in the world today, and it's my prayer that as people listen to this, they will be more equipped on how to pray.
Yes.
And more equipped of what kind of action they can take to relieve the suffering of so many that are under the tyrannical regimes of like Kim Il-sung in the north and other tyrants throughout the world, Mugabe and Zimbabwe. There's just many everywhere. And so hopefully this will help equip especially believers to know how to act and pray.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so yeah, I guess I could go ahead and begin. As I've been thinking about tonight, this is a preliminary consideration in view of the planned roundtable discussion that we're going to have next Saturday, a week from this Saturday rather, on the occult connection and foundations of the communist regime in North Korea and even China, to allow those that have that we've been working with as ritual abuse survivors to tell their testimonies as to how they were used by the enemy to power up these regimes. They are powered up through rituals, through the release of satanic powers that just create a tyrannical regime, which is satanic at its very foundation. So that's something that we plan on doing next week, and so this is preparation for that time. So I wanted us to just turn to Isaiah 25, and I'm just going to read this passage, and then we're going to take it apart and look at the significance of this passage in terms of its prophetic framework as well as its implications as it affects the peoples and the nations today. In Isaiah 25 we have, of course, a song of praise to God from the remnant that God is, of course, will ultimately redeem in the tribulation, but also there's a near view that pertains to the people of God in Isaiah's day. But in the context of the passage we're going to look at, or we're going to focus on tonight, in Isaiah 25, verse 7, I want to start with verse 6, because we have a prophetic statement here through Isaiah concerning the coming of the Lord. And I think everyone's heard of the wedding supper of the Lamb, that when Jesus returns, there's going to be this big banquet inaugurating his 1,000-year reign here on earth. He mentions that in the Gospels. And so this is a reference to the inauguration of his reign as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And so beginning reading from the New American Standard Version in Isaiah 25 and verse 6, "And the Lord of hosts," the Lord of the armies, this means the God who is sovereign over all things, seen and unseen. He's like the commander-in-chief. "The Lord of hosts will prepare a lavish banquet for all peoples on this mountain." This mountain refers to Mount Zion. Today that would be the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. "He will prepare a banquet of aged wine, choice pieces with marl, and refined aged wine." For those that are wine bibbers, this will exceed Chateau Lafite Rothschild 1961.
Yes.
So it will be the best. And then verse 7, "And on this mountain he will swallow up the covering which is over all the peoples, even the veil which is stretched or woven over all the nations. We need to look at that more closely. And then we notice the word that is repeated again, and he will swallow up for all time. He will swallow up death for all time. And the Lord God will wipe tears away from all faces. He will remove the reproach of his people from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. And it will be said on that day, behold, this is our God for whom we have waited, that he might save or rescue us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. That is his final deliverance of his people as a nation. So this is the passage that has been very instructive to us here, Georgianne, as we have been working with ritual abuse survivors for 25 years. We've come to understand in the last 5 or 6 years that through the trauma-based mind control, the fragmentation, the shattering of the person's soul, and the way the adversary can interface even with aspects of the person's human spirit that is shivered off. They can't touch that innermost connection between the person and the Lord, but the adversary will steal whatever he can, and he will interface with that and project himself as a veil over the nations. And this is something we've come to learn over a period of time. So it's important that we understand the contemporary ramifications of this particular passage as it relates to tyrannical regimes and the oppressive governments like what we see in North Korea. Hopefully this will help people understand how to understand what is going on in the spiritual realm. I want to read just several translations of Isaiah 25:7. The New English translation, it sounds like this. On this mountain, he, the Lord, will swallow up the shroud that is over all peoples, the woven covering that is over all the nations. And in the footnote, it says, the point of the imagery is unclear. Perhaps the shroud or the covering was associated with death in some way, because of the same word swallowed up as it is used in verse 8. And that is true. There is a connection between the veil and the death that is swallowed up in verse 8. And the NIV is translated this way, on this mountain, Mount Zion, the Temple Mount, he, the Lord, will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. Very interesting. Of course, the New American Standard Bible, which I use, on this mountain, he, the Lord, will swallow up the covering which is over all peoples, even the veil which is stretched over all the nations. So that is what we're going to be looking at tonight. And I think to begin with, just a note from the Defender's Bible on this particular passage. A note here is a covering cast over all the peoples, as it's in the Defender's Bible notes. This covering and veil probably refers to the death shroud, which eventually covers every face. So it would be the idea of a mourning shroud, or of when people in the East would go to a funeral, they put a veil. I mean, they would be covered in black, representing mourning and death. So that is also a part of the imagery. And then this comment from the Defender's Bible goes on to say, this, that is the veil, will be removed in the coming resurrection, or at the return of the Lord. And then continuing with the Defender's Bible notes, this veil that is spread over all the nations, quote, despite the widespread human opinion that every nation has its own religion and should be encouraged to practice it, the Bible clearly teaches, here and elsewhere, that all nations are blinded, cut off from God's truth by a deadly veil.
Yes.
Satan, who is described through the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4, which says, the God of this world, the Greek is the God of this age, has blinded the minds of them who do not believe. Only when the true saving gospel of Jesus Christ reaches their minds and hearts, then that veil is taken away. 2 Corinthians 3, verses 14-15. When it says, when anyone turns to the Lord, the veil is removed from their hearts. And that's the key. But as we read in this passage, we see that this veil is over all peoples and all nations. Notice the description there in verse 7. He will swallow up the covering which is over, notice, all peoples. Not some peoples, all peoples. Even the veil which is stretched over, not some of the nations, all nations. That's inclusive. And so this is something that we need to consider. And of course, in the round table that we have planned, we'll be looking at, we'll be listening to the testimonies of those that have been involved with rituals since the early 50s, satanic rituals that occurred to empower tyrants like Mao Zedong and Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and even more recently, Kim Jong-il's successor, Kim Jong-un. And so we know that as a result of the horrific events that took place in Nazi Germany with the ritual murder of 6 million Jews, and I refer to it as a ritual murder because I believe through that sacrifice, that the Holocaust, that a portal was opened in Mount Hermon, where the original 200 watchers came down in Genesis 6, cohabited with women to produce a hybrid offspring. I believe as a result of that event that occurred, the horrific sacrifice of 6 million Jews, and of course there were upwards of 10 million Christians that were also killed, as well as various people that were considered mentally handicapped and not suitable to their regime in terms of health and virility. So we see that that Mount Hermon, we've talked about this in other sessions, that a portal was opened so that conception could occur again, as in Genesis 6, with the production of offspring. And then there's a link with the Temple Mount as the strategic global center of Satan's dominion. I personally believe, I cannot prove this, but we know from Revelation chapter 2 that the Church of Pergamum, it is specifically, there's a specific reference that at Pergamum, Satan's throne was located.
Yes.
His throne was not located at Ephesus or Thyatira or Smyrna or Philadelphia or Laodicea. It was located specifically at Pergamum. And there's a reason for that, because that connects that part of the world back to the old Babylonian religion that was that came over from the east into that region to counter Christianity. So we see that the Mount Hermon is the portal, but Mount Zion is the anchor point. Mount Zion is the stronghold and the seat of Satan's throne, I believe, from the foundation of the nation of Israel in 1948 to the present. By necessity, he's moved his throne there, which we will see by just noticing the strategic importance of Mount Zion. In other words, you know, when he says, upon this mountain, he will swallow up the covering. What mountain? That's Mount Zion. So I just want to just refer to several verses where Mount Zion is used in the Bible. The very first place it was used is in 2 Samuel 5, when David conquered the Jebusite fortress there in Jerusalem. It was the stronghold. It was a Jebusite stronghold, and when David's men conquered that stronghold, it became the stronghold of David, or Mount Zion. So the Jebusite stronghold, when it was conquered by David, became the stronghold of David, and therefore the stronghold of the Lord. But it had to be conquered. And so the very first reference to Mount Zion is found in 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 7. It is referred to in 1 Kings 8:1 as the city of David. I would just encourage anyone that may not be familiar with this, with the strategic importance of Zion, is just to take a concordance and just go down through that concordance and notice all the ways in which Zion is used, beginning with 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 7, all the way to actually Revelation chapter 14, verse 1. And in fact, in the Old Testament, all the way through Zechariah 9, verse 13. So it's just a plethora of references to the significance and centrality of the Temple Mount, which is Jerusalem, which is Mount Zion in Jerusalem. And so we see also from Psalm 2:6, with reference to the exaltation and glorification of Jesus Christ, the Lord says, "I have installed my king upon Zion," that the near view refers to the heavenly Zion, the Zion that embodies the fullness of Christ and his dominion now in union with the church. But it also looks forward to his return to establish his millennial kingdom, his rule and reign on earth, on the earthly Zion, which is in Jerusalem. And often Zion and Jerusalem are used interchangeably in the Bible. But Zion is the ideal of what God intended Jerusalem to be. Jerusalem is not only the capital of Israel, but in the millennium, the thousand-year reign of Christ, Jerusalem will be the capital of the entire world. It will be the head of all nations. And so we could understand something of the significance of why Satan would want to occupy that ground in advance of Jesus coming to return to this earth and to occupy that place. So Psalm 2:6, when it says, "I've installed my king upon Zion," that will ultimately have its realization when Jesus comes back to earth to rule from Jerusalem and from the Temple Mount. His throne will actually be there. In Psalm 99:2, it says, "The Lord is great in Zion." And if we see in Psalm 110:2 that the strong scepter, that is the dominion of the Lord, comes forth from Zion. And so throughout the millennial reign of Christ, the rule of God in the person of Jesus Christ as the Messiah, he will rule the entire world from Zion, Psalm 110:2. It says in Psalm 120:5, "The Lord bless you from Zion." So throughout the entire 1,000-year reign, when Jesus Christ rules as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, all blessings will flow to the nations from Zion. So Zion is the Temple Mount. And it says in Isaiah 1, verse 27, that Zion will be redeemed with justice. Right now, Zion is occupied by a Muslim shrine. There's a Muslim shrine to Allah that is occupying that place. So that's like Islam in the face of God saying, "I belong here, you don't, Jesus Christ."
Yes.
It's a flaunting. That's not a holy site of Islam. That site never belonged to the Muslims. That land belonged to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob before there was any Muslim anywhere in the vicinity. But Zion will be redeemed with justice. That's what the word says. And if a person just takes a concordance and just looks up Zion, remember, this is the Temple Mount. The Temple Institute in Israel is very involved in preparations for the coming functional priesthood and the temple that will be in operation during the time of Jacob's trouble. The very temple that the Antichrist will set up, the abomination of desolation, his image, is all that is in advanced stages of preparation. So, in reading in Isaiah 24, verse 23, it says, "The Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion." He will reign. Well, he's not there now. Who's on Mount Zion now? Who's on the Temple Mount? Allah. So, when we think about the conflict in the Middle East between Jews and Arabs, this is not a conflict between Jews and Arabs. This is a conflict between Yahweh and Allah. And it will be settled on the battlefield of Armageddon, who the Most High is. And we already know the outcome. We see that there are many, many passages. We see that the Lord has a recompense for the cause of Zion, or for the controversy of Zion, in Isaiah 34, verse 8. We see when Jesus Christ comes back, according to Isaiah 59:20, a redeemer will come to Zion. That is, here on earth, he will come to the Temple Mount. He will first come to the Mount of Olives, Actually, he goes to the kingdom of Esau, Isaiah 63. Then to the Mount of Olives, his feet will touch down, according to Zechariah 14. But then from there, once he is returned to this earth, according to the prophetic word, he returns to the Mount of Olives. He will then establish his throne on Mount Zion. We see again, he will come to Zion and bring redemption to Israel, Isaiah 59:20. There are many, many passages which I'm passing up, but we see in Zechariah 1, verse 14, that the Lord is exceedingly jealous for Jerusalem and Zion. And it says in Zechariah 1:17, the Lord will again comfort Zion. And again, Zechariah 8:2, I am exceedingly jealous for Zion, and I will return to Zion, and I will dwell there, Zechariah 8:3. And then we see, of course, in Revelation 14, verse 1, that when Jesus returns at the second advent, there's the reference that John saw the Lamb standing on Mount Zion with 144,000 of the Jewish remnant. So those are just a few references to the significance of this particular area of the world. In fact, Ezekiel chapter 5, verse 5, says that Jerusalem is the center of the whole world. It's the center. It's like the hub. And so from the standpoint of biblical prophecy and understanding, that's important. So let us look more closely at this passage in Isaiah 25, verse 7. And if God is going to swallow up death on that mountain, well then Satan, who is the Lord of death, who is the one who is the embodiment of spiritual death, will by necessity be occupying that territory prior to Jesus Christ coming to establish his kingdom. And that's why I said, I believe from the foundation of Israel in 1948, he de facto, by necessity, moved his throne most likely from Germany to Israel in order to prepare for the final battle between God and Satan, as we see in Revelation 16, I think verse 13 and, through 17, and Revelation 17, 12 through 14, and then Revelation 19:19, I believe those verses, if my memory serves me right. So let's look more closely at this passage Isaiah 25 and verse 7. So as we already read, I'll just read it again so that we can begin to take this apart a little bit and see the somewhat startling message that is encrypted in the original Hebrew language. In other words, if you were to hear this in the Hebrew language, you would hear certain words and sounds that would have nuances that would connect you with other thoughts and scriptural references. You don't get it in the translation, so I'm going to seek to bring out a couple of key thoughts that are in Isaiah 25:7 to help us understand the meaning and the significance of this passage. So it begins like this, and on this mountain, he will swallow up the covering. And so that word swallow up is bala. It's the same, it means to devour, to swallow up, or to... Frequently, the word bala is used as a symbol of destruction and ruin, such as Lamentations 2:5 and 2:8, Isaiah 3:12, etc. So, the Lord is going to he's going to swallow up this veil. Now, notice what comes first: the veil has to be removed before he can swallow up death. He will swallow up death by resurrection. In verse 8, we see that. This verse is actually quoted in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 54, with reference to the resurrection. So the only way God can swallow up death is through resurrection. Well, the church will be the first to be resurrected, and then the next phase of swallowing up death is when Jesus returns and he raises Old Testament saints to life, and then at the very end of the thousand-year reign, death will be swallowed up with finality, and there'll be a new heavens and new earth. So it's just kind of a sweep, and that's how the passage is what it's referring to here. So notice, Before there can be the swallowing up of death through resurrection, verse 8, there first must be the swallowing up of the covering that is over all the nations. Now we're going to look at these words a little more closely and just see the Hebrew here, which is quite amazing. The first part of Isaiah 25, verse 7, and he, the Lord, on this mountain, Mount Zion, the Temple Mount, he will swallow up the covering which is over all the peoples. It's the same word. The covering is the noun, and then the passive participle of the same Hebrew word, covering, which is covering all the peoples. I think it's translated over. But the covering, which is covering over all peoples. And so it's the face of the covering. Now we're going to look at that word covering. First of all, we're just going to stand back a little bit and look at the wide view. The first reference here, this covering, in the use of the word, is related to magical arts. It's related to supernatural demonic activity. In other words, this covering has a spiritual force and a spiritual background to it. And so there's spiritual forces. There's magic, as we will see, that is involved in Satan weaving this covering over the nations. Secondly, the next term implies ritual. It implies satanic ritual that is used to release this power. So in the very use of the Hebrew words, we have an interconnection with occult power and satanic ritual. So just reading that, you wouldn't see that, Georgianne. I mean, you would not, just looking at those verses, wouldn't see that.
Yeah.
If you heard it in the Hebrew, you would make the connection. That's what we're going to be doing right now.
Okay.
So he says, on this mountain he will swallow up the covering which is over all the peoples. This particular term, lut in the Hebrew, it represents an envelope or a covering. But it also, the very term is used in Exodus chapter 7, verse 11, verse 22, Exodus 8, 7. It is used in the plural with the preposition to refer to the enchantments or secret arts practiced by Pharaoh's magicians. So when we talk about a covering, we're talking about the employing or the implementation of occult powers through incantation, secret arts. The same root word is used there. And so we see that this word refers to enchantments or secret arts practiced by Pharaoh's magicians in their attempt to keep up with Moses and Aaron's plagues of God. And so I thought that was an insightful statement.
Yes.
Now we're going to look at just a second here. I got to go get my notes here that just fell on the floor. Excuse me.
Okay.
Thought I had them here. Let me look for them here. Sorry for the delay here, but all my notes seem to have got raptured. Oh, here they are. And they didn't get raptured after all. They just fell off. I'm sitting here in my comfortable chair here, Georgianne, and it doesn't always serve me as well as a desk. I usually use a desk to do this. But again, the term here is, as we look at that first term, we'll read it again. He will swallow up the covering which is over all the peoples. The word covering, this particular word, lut, in the Hebrew lexicon, it lists this as two separate roots. But when you hear it, you couldn't help but make the association between a wrap or something closely or tightly enwrapped, envelop. It has the idea of cleaving and sticking to a thing, something that adheres. It's also figurative of a covering as a sign of mourning. In other words, it's related to spiritual death. And so this particular reference here, taken from Brown, Driver, and Briggs' Hebrew Lexicon, says that this is the it's a figure of mourning, the surface covering the nations. It's covering like a mourning veil to envelop or wrap. But then in the next usage, it means secrecy or mystery. It's interesting. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 7, Paul says, the mystery of iniquity is already supernaturally operational. That is energeia. And the word mystery there, it means secret. It's a mysterion. It means a secret. And so we see the connection here between enchantments or magical rites as being that which Satan has used to create this veil. So it envelops or covers all peoples and all nations. And then in the Gesenius Hebrew lexicon, he has these notes under this particular Hebrew term. It means to cover over, to hide, to wrap up. It means through the use of hidden or secret arts. In other words, to do something in secret, secret arts. Incantations, as I already mentioned, as the word is used in Egyptians, the Egyptian magicians in Pharaoh's court in Exodus 7, 22, 8, 3, and 8, 14, etc. Also, a similar word in Exodus 7, 11. And so the word has come to convey the idea of a covering veil, as it is used in Isaiah 25, 7, the covering which is spread over all the nations, the veil which keeps their hearts from God. And so we see that horrific situation that is over the peoples today. And isn't it interesting that the very center, the anchor point, well, all the survivors I've worked with, Georgianne, the anchor point, the seal of all that which has happened to them is right there under the Temple Mount in Jerusalem.
Oh, dear.
And we did a whole special on the Zedekiah's cave one time. I don't know if it was on this program or what, but...
We did that.
Did we do the Zedekiah's cave?
Yeah.
And I also did one of our friends, Kathleen Pearl, who's a missionary to Israel and to the nations. She went to Mount Hermon, and I did a prayer, a confession and prayer warfare pronouncement in a year ago, right there in Mount Hermon. And she posted that on her website. She says it's received more hits than anything else on her website. So when I saw the strategic character and nature of Mount Zion, I felt it is important for us to see its connection, especially what we're going to be looking at this next week around North Korea and it's called the Hermit Kingdom, but the tyrannical rule of Kim Il-sung and now the current despot that's there now is Kim Jong-il. It's just horrific what is going on there. Now, let's go to the next verb. So word. So we could say, on this mountain, that is Mount Zion, He, the Lord, will swallow up the veil, which is that covers or veils all the peoples. Even the veil, and that word could be translated web, which is woven over all the nations. So in the first word, it conveys the idea of magical arts and witchcraft. In other words, drawing on the spiritual forces of darkness that would make up this covering. But the next verb, or the next word in the sentence, the second part of the sentence of Isaiah 25, verse 7, is very interesting. It's the Hebrew term nasak. It again has the same three consonants, nasak, but the lexicons list it as two different words. So in the Hebrew, if you were to listen to this, you would hear both nuances. In other words, you would connect both nuances with this particular term that is the second one, and it is nasak, and it means, according to Gesenius, it means one to pour out or make a libation. It is used in Isaiah 30. Verse 1, if you go there, it is used as a covenant with another nation, like Israel making a covenant with Egypt, which God was very displeased with. And if you look at Isaiah 30, verse 1, woe to the rebellious children, referring to the children of Israel, declares the Lord, who execute a plan but not mine, who make an alliance but not by my spirit, in order to add sin to sin, who proceed down to Egypt without consulting me, to take refuge in the safety of Pharaoh and seek shelter in the shadow of Egypt. And then he goes on and gives the prophetic warning. But see that word there in Isaiah 30, verse 1? Make an alliance? Literally, it's to pour out a drink offering. To pour out a drink offering. Nasak. Well, it's the exact same word used in that second line in Isaiah 25 and verse 7. Which to me, when I saw this, it was quite amazing to see the connection. So first you have the implication of the usage of occult power in the first word. In the second word, this term Nasak has the idea in honor of a god, to make a libation, therefore an agreement. Or in Isaiah 30 verse 1, to make a covenant, because the ancients, in making covenants, were accustomed to offer libations, you know, and drink offerings, and such as that. So I think when we just think about what we're going to be looking at in a week or so, just the significance of these passages as they relate to the history of the people that we've been working with all these years, I think it's going to be a real eye opener to many who may not have made the connection before this time. So there we see the connection. The second way this used is a second root. It means, in the same word, nasak, it means to intertwine, to weave, to hedge. It's from the idea of to cover or to protect. So it's the same word as to create a covenant through a libation. So we see to weave or to form a web. And so we can see from this passage that the adversary had throughout history, leading up to the second coming of the Lord, that on this mountain the Lord will swallow up the covering that has been established through magical rites and occult rituals, which is woven over all the peoples, and the veil, that which has been established through rituals, through that web that is woven over all the nations. And then once that has been accomplished, which will occur, it is going on right now during the church age, it will have its culminating act in the tribulation. But then when Jesus returns, we see the outworking of that in verse 8, when he will swallow up death. But he can't swallow up death until he first deals with the occult powers and the rituals that have gone down, especially not only throughout all the church age, but as they have been concentrated and focused since post-World War Nazi Germany up to the present. And those are some of the things we're going to be looking at when we do our roundtable discussion with the survivors and their involvement with North Korea. And so continuing on with our consideration here, having looked at those passages, Mount Hermon, I think just to back up and just think about what has happened to the people that are here. This is what's been reported. I remember when Dan, when we've been working with him for a number of years, and it unfolded very slowly.
Yeah.
And because when as a little boy, when he was, I think he was actually born right there under the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. That's where all the people now know where they're actually born there, so they could be anchored in Satan's throne.
Yeah.
In terms of the stronghold that he was building through these people, through their bloodline and their connections with the families, here's the way they described it. With, for example, right at birth, with women, they were actually conceived in Mount Hermon, but the birth takes place in what they call a birthing trough under the Temple Mount of Jerusalem. They report a room where the seat of Antichrist is. The seat of the false prophet, Satan's throne, right there in Mount Zion under the Temple Mount, there's a birthing trough where these people are born. And with all kinds of elaborate rituals with heads of state. And I will only use, I could speak with each one, but I won't go into all the details. I'll just use Dan and the way his story has unfolded. At birth, at Jerusalem, from there, well, for the girls, they went from conception to the Temple Mount, and with Dan, he was included too because it represents a stronghold from the conception at Mount Hermon to birth at under the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. That's the sequence, okay? And so that stronghold would be anchored right there at their birth in Jerusalem, and then for Dan, he went from Jerusalem. He was taken from Jerusalem to Kashi. And it's so amazing, George, and through the years, Dan has been enamored. Did anybody see the movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
Oh, yes.
Remember, he was, as he sat at the table, he would kind of get transfixed. He would take his mashed potatoes and make these mountains.
Yes.
Because there's something inside of him that just wouldn't go away.
Right.
That represented some encounter he had. And it just was in his mind. He was just reliving it in different ways. Well, this is what it was with Dan. He always had this picture in his mind of these mountain peaks, and he was just wanting to know the connection for many, many years. He thought it was in Austria because he spent a whole year with Dr. Josef Mengele as a little boy there, and so he thought it was Austria. But when we got in more and deeply into his work in the mid 2005 or so, 2004, 2005, he began to think about China. And of course, that's when I went to China for the first time in 2005. So it's interesting how all this has unfolded. But he began to be interested in Kashi, which is in the northwest province of Xinjiang, China. It's a Muslim dominated. So it's on the western border of China. So Kashi or Kagar is another way to describe it. This is he began to be, you know, just really interested in that, just pursuing that. And when we looked at pictures of that particular region, he saw pictures of mountains. He says, "That's it." He knew he had been there. And then as the Lord continued to unfold this, he recognized that he went first. From Jerusalem, he was taken by King George VI, his father, and others, and then taken to Kashi with horrific rituals, horrific abuse, and then a part of his life essence was anchored right there, dimensionally anchored, through ritual right there in Kashi. What was the purpose? That's where the Back to Jerusalem vision had its beginning, with the Jesus family. The God's call, if no one has read the book Back to Jerusalem by Paul Hadaway, or Heavenly Man, which is the story of Brother Yoon, it was in this region that co-workers, Simon Zhao, they received the vision from God that the church in China was to complete the Great Commission back to Jerusalem. Mm. And so so now we know that anchor point was to thwart the end time goal of God to complete the Great Commission. Plus, it was out of northwest China that Mao Zedong and his armies, came from the northwest and swept across China and ultimately defeated the nationalist forces of Chiang Kai-shek. And of course, communism took over as a result as of 1949. But they were empowered. They were empowered through ritual. And so Jerusalem to Kashi, then back to Jerusalem. 3 months later, Jerusalem to Peking. Then back to Jerusalem. 3 months later, Jerusalem to the Yalu River. So we see it's like a web. It's interesting. Dan's surrogate name is Daniel Webb.
Oh.
So he was actually structured to be a veil or a web over the nations as the firstborn son of King George VI. I mean, this is all done on a spiritual level. I mean, Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, we wrestle not with human beings, flesh and blood, but with principalities and powers, with the world rulers, the cosmocrators of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenlies. Now, what is spiritual forces? That's what we're talking about. These spiritual forces can interface with who we are as spiritual beings, and through trauma, through demonization, create a web. So as Dan was taken on these circuits, and of course the girls were too, they were taken to Tibet, interfaced with the Tibetan masters, all to create a web and like a seal over the whole 1040 window. And so Satan has a very clear strategy to thwart the coming of the Lord, and that's exactly what this is about. So then, why the Yalu River? Because that's the river that separates China and Korea, and he remembers just hundreds of girls being ritually sacrificed and drowned in that river. So that river represents a barrier of death separating Korea and China. And so the Hermit Kingdom, as it is now called, Korea, there's a lot of rituals that went down in the early, starting 1949 on, that our people will be talking about, George Ann, in the release of satanic power to power up these regimes. So then he went from Pyongyang River, which was a river of death and ritual sacrifice. By the way, drowning was one of the three primary ways in which the old Druidic religions sacrificed their victims. It was drowning, strangulation, or death by the sword, decapitation, I believe it is. They had three different ways to do it. Then back to Jerusalem. Then 3 months later, where was he taken? 38th parallel. And why the 38th parallel? To create, for rituals there, to create not just a physical barrier separating North and South Korea. There's a spiritual barrier. All these women that we're going to be interviewing have been taken into these tunnels underneath, that are between underneath the 38th parallel, that are there. They're by the North Koreans, and rituals have occurred to create a power structure and a wall of separation between the two kingdoms. Okay, so from the 38th parallel, and Dan remembers that on that 38th parallel, at this age, is every 3 months, so I don't forget how old he was, he stretched out both hands, and out of him came the power of Antichrist. Satan came out of him, and as he was facing the west, and the darkness, or Apollyon, went to the north, and the false light, like yin and yang, went to the south, or Nimrod. It's the same power, but it's light and dark, yin and yang, and it came out of him. He was aware of this. And then from the 38th parallel, he was taken back to Jerusalem again, and 3 months later, taken down to Fuzhou, which is on the eastern coast of China. Why Fuzhou? That's where Watchman Nee was born. That's where his ministry had its beginning. And the whole house church movement, in terms of how it functions, can be a large percentage. Some say anywhere from 70 to 90% can be traced back to the spiritual history of Watchman Nee and the founding of these churches and the advance of the gospel. So Fuzhou, to create a stronghold there, to thwart anything that would represent the future work of God in China. And then back to Jerusalem. And then from Jerusalem to Singapore. Why Singapore? Because that's the complete opposite of what we see in Korea in the north. It's like a westernized, in Singapore, is much like the church in the west. It's in some respects, it's very westernized. When I was there over a year ago, there wasn't much different than the church in the west. And that doesn't represent all the churches there, because I didn't see them all, but it's very different than being in the house churches in China. So that anchors the darkness. You have light and dark, North and South Korea, then you sweep around, then you create an anchor, and there was a seal that was put in place through drowning in a lake in Singapore, and I went to that lake and did prayer. When I was there, Georgian, and did specific prayers in the lake that was identified where rituals occurred, and there was ritual drownings and resuscitation. When I made specific prayers, a person was released from association with spiritual death in Singapore. Mm-hmm. I've been in Singapore praying, and they were in New York, and there were aspects of their dissociative identity, their dissociative structure that was released as a result of this. And then, so that completes the circuit. So if you look at a map, and you look at Jerusalem, and you look at how this web was woven, it covers the entire 1040 window. Entire 1040 window.
Wow.
And I think that is so incredible. Why the 1040 window? These are the last people groups that have not heard the gospel, that Jesus said, this gospel of the kingdom will be preach to all nations, and then the end shall come. Matthew 24. We'll look at that passage. We'll just look at it right now. Matthew 24. So why does... I mean, this is a preemptive move. This veil of death, this veil of mourning and death, was actually woven through satanic ritual through all these years over these nations. For what purpose? To thwart the consummation of this age. It is Satan's end game, his last stand to thwart the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. I want to read this passage in Matthew 24, just this few verses here, and the whole passage, along with its parallel passage, Mark 13, is referred to as the Olivet Discourse. But just begin reading at Matthew 24:11, and he says, Jesus says, many false prophets will arise and will mislead, that is, deceive many. And because of lawlessness, because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end, it is he who shall be saved. But what he's talking about here, as the Jewish remnant, as they endure to the end until Jesus Christ comes back to rescue them, Isaiah 59, I think, what, verses 20, when he comes back to rescue them, they have to endure. They have to go through Daniel's 70th week. They have to go through the tribulation and the great tribulation period, which will be ruled by Antichrist. They have a lot to endure. So he says, those who endure to the end will be saved. They will be rescued. They'll be delivered. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world, the whole inhabited earth, literally, for a witness to all nations, then the end shall come. Notice, it doesn't say conversion. The nations won't be converted. They will be, it's a witness. They will be held accountable. As we see in the book of Revelation, we see the sealing of the 144,000 Jews and Revelation 7, all but the tribe of Dan, they're sealed, and these are the first fruits, according to Revelation 14, 1 through 5. These are the first fruits of that Jewish remnant that God will use to evangelize the nations. Plus, the everlasting gospel will be proclaimed from the heavens through angelic agency, so it'll be a massive time of evangelism. There'll be many saved in the tribulation. As we read from Revelation 7, verse 14, those that are saved in the tribulation are beyond number. They're from every kindred, nation, tribe, and tongue. So this prophecy that Jesus gave in Matthew 24 will be realized. I think I'd like to go back and just have us notice Matthew chapter 10 as it relates to the outworking of God's plan to see this age consummated. We know in Matthew chapter 10 that Jesus called his disciples, who were also apostles, and he commissioned them. He commissioned them, Matthew 10 and verse 5, and instructed them, do not go in the way of the Gentiles. Do not enter into the city of the Samaritans, that is half Jew and half Gentile, but rather go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And why? Because he came to the Jewish people first to fulfill the covenants and promises he made to the fathers, according to Luke chapter 1, verse 68 and following, to fulfill the promise made to the fathers. And it says in Matthew 15, verse 24, that Jesus made this statement to the Gentile, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So he came to fulfill the promises made to the fathers, and then the first Gentile wasn't even saved until Acts chapter 10. That's an important dispensational hermeneutic for those that don't know the difference between the church, Israel, and the nations. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 30. Three different categories of mankind.
Good point.
And so he says, go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So he gives them instructions. And this, of course, would be post-resurrection, but it also includes while he was there, he would send them out two by two, and they would go into the various cities prior to his arrival and prepare the way. And so as you read through his instructions of sending his disciples out ahead of him, he gives them this warning in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 16. And this is very, very interesting to me, as we will see here in a moment. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves. These are apostles. They're going forth as missionaries. Beware of men, for they will deliver you up to the courts, that is, to the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Sanhedrin, and scourge you in their synagogues. Well, we see that that happened in the book of Acts, don't we? So this is prophetic, and it touches even the post-resurrection experience of these apostles. And he says, verse 18, you shall even be brought before governors and kings for my sake as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. Well, we see that in Acts 22. We see that in the life of Paul. So this is prophetic. But when they deliver you up, do not become anxious about how or what you will speak, for it shall be given you in that hour what you are to speak. For it is not you who speak, but it is the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. And brother will deliver up brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. And you will be hated by all on account of me, but it is the one who has endured to the end who will be saved. That is, who will be rescued when Jesus returns at the second advent. So notice how this prophecy telescopes. It's elastic. It has a near view that refers to the initial ministry of the apostles, but then the prophecy telescopes. It projects to the end times when there are 144,000 and others of the Jewish remnant, as we see in Zechariah 9 and following, will be used to proclaim the gospel to the Gentiles. The church will not be there because the Jews will again be the ambassadors of God in that phase of the kingdom. So he says, verse 23, whenever they persecute you in this city, flee to the next. Who's he speaking to? He's speaking to his own disciples. But that you, telescopes, as we're going to see in a moment, it not only has a near view, referring to the 12 apostles, of course, minus Judas, replaced by Matthias, but we see it telescopes and has an eschatological view that will be fulfilled in the tribulation. So he says, and you will be hated on account of my name, verse 23, but whenever they persecute you in this city, flee to the next. Let me go back to 22. And you will be hated by all on account of me, and it is the one who has endured to the end who will be saved. That is the end of the tribulation period when Jesus returns to deliver his remnant. Verse 23. But whenever they persecute you in this city, notice, whenever they persecute you, that you has a near view. He's talking to the 12 here, but that you also telescopes to an end time company of Jews that includes 144,000 and those mentioned in Zechariah 9, chapter 9 and following. They will persecute you in the city, flee to the next. Now watch this. For truly I say to you, you shall not finish going through the cities of Israel till the Son of Man comes. That's eschatological. So we have a near view and then a far view when the Israel will be evangelized by Jewish evangelists and then the end will come. So it's quite an amazing thing. And that's why the whole back to... I would really encourage people to obtain the book called the Back to Jerusalem by Paul Hadaway and read that. I met a dear friend that's featured in that book, Peter Hsu. I look forward to... I'm planning on seeing him again in about 2 or 3 weeks for a meeting. I spent time with him 3 years ago in Los Angeles with a week of meetings. Also had the opportunity to meet one of his disciples, Brother Yoon, the Heavenly Man. If his readers, or listeners rather, have not read the book, The Heavenly Man, the incredible story of Brother Yoon, of his imprisonment in China, you'll never be the same. Anyone who reads Heavenly Man, you will not be the same. Same thing with Back to Jerusalem. Well, this whole Back to Jerusalem vision is what God has called the church in China to fulfill, and Satan has preempted this. He has preempted this through all these rituals I just described, and so it's an amazing story that is unfolding. I don't know that it has ever been told in this generation. If it has, I'm not aware of it. So it is wonderful that we have this opportunity on the Bite Show to talk about these things, for these others to share their testimony. So I really encourage people to be in praying about our time together next Saturday. When we look at the occult history behind the founding of North Korea, as well as China, the role of satanic rituals that they have played for the empowerment of these satanic regimes. And so we'll be able to hear the testimonies of these people, and I believe that the Lord is going to use this mightily, because it's when these things that are in the darkness come to light, that's when Satan is weakened. He cannot operate in the light. He has to operate in secrecy and darkness, like we see in the Hebrew words that we just looked at in Isaiah 25:7. So when things are there in the darkness are brought out in the light, it weakens his hold. And we are praying that something very significant this year will happen for the bringing down of that North Korean regime and the collapse of that communist regime and the liberation, not only of the North Korean people who are held captive, but the thousands of Christians who are being persecuted unto death just for having Bibles. So I think this is where I will close this session for tonight, and I trust that this will be helpful for some.
Oh, Douglas, what goes on in North Korea is horrific. And I've posted things, prayer requests for North Korean people. We can't imagine that. Oh my God, it's just horrific. The churches have to meet in utter secrecy and be concerned about being killed.
Yeah,
it's
true.
And it's true, they cannot own a Bible. It's it's just beyond.
Yeah, it is. It's quite amazing. I was just reading this. I'd recommend people contact the Voice of the Martyrs. They have a bookstore.
Yes.
They contact the Voice of the Martyrs, VOM, probably VOM.com, the Voice of the Martyrs. There's a book titled Restricted Nations, North Korea. Restricted Nations, North Korea. There are other excellent resources there, too. I'm just going to read just a couple little things here, just since you mentioned that.
Okay.
This is just a report about North Korea. It says, today in China, Christians are ready and willing to take in fleeing North Koreans, offering them not only food and shelter, but also bread of life, living water of the gospel message. North Koreans know the risk. For those in China who offer them aid, they know fines and arrests await all who are caught helping refugees. As they see the willing spirit of service and sacrifice, as well as the warm sense of peace in the lives of Christian workers, many are drawn to follow the Savior who called those workers there. If any refugees choose to trust in Christ, they are offered a Bible and discipleship training in order to drive deep roots into His Word. These are those who have escaped North Korea, the horrific regime. Many of those who are disciples have a great desire to return to their country and share the gospel with their friends and families. Those left behind suffer under oppressive regime. And in this book, he describes let me go back another page here. I probably shouldn't read some of this because it may be just it's too graphic. I think people should
read
it on their own.
Yes, I disagree. People need to hear these things. They've been babied long enough.
Well, I will see. I was just trying to find. Wasn't really prepared. There's so much here. The whole book is. You can read it in one sitting. I'll just quote from memory. The starvation, the whole population, a whole city, had 130,000 people had to leave because of starvation. Kim Jong-il is drinking cognac at the tune of $700,000 a year while people are starving. He bought 1,000 Swiss watches, you know, for I don't know how many dollars, while people are starving. People were so hungry this little boy was crouching down, eating, cannibalizing a dead body, and a North Korean soldier walked up and shot him in the head.
Yes.
This is a little boy. I mean, they're just, you see the pictures of these people who are just skeletons, while this son of Belial, Kim Jong-il, pontificates and has everyone worship him as a god. When I read this book, I got angry, Georgia.
Oh.
I got angry, and I called my friend Peter Hsu, who is very much involved, and what can we do? What can be done about the liberation of North Korea? This son of Belial needs to come down. Whoever this Kim Jong-il is, he needs to discover he's but a man. And the fact that his father, Kim Il-sung, is worshipped as the eternal president, the great leader, as he's called, and his son, Kim Jong-il, who's now in power, great teacher, or great leader, it's just horrific what has gone on. And you know, Robert Park was very suicidal and very, very upset, who
yes.
went into North Korea and was horrifically tortured for proclaiming the gospel. But he couldn't just sit by knowing that his own Korean brethren were suffering there. So he shouldn't have gone in alone. He should have gone two by two. But we're going to pray, Georgianne, and it's in the works that we will be able to interview him and let him tell his story and talk about we have the opportunity to give him a voice, Georgianne, and
yes.
speak to the church and speak to the West what needs to be done for the liberation of the people of North Korea. And I want to give Robert Park the opportunity to do that. So it's in the works right now.
Robert Park was beaten, tortured, sodomized by the North Korean guards, security forces, whatever they are. He, bless his heart, he has been through hell. He is a good man, carrying a good message. And this happened to him, and it's just, Douglas, I can't find the words to express.
I know, I can't either, and I know that when I saw his anguish as he knelt down in front of the parliament there in Seoul, South Korea.
Yeah.
This is after he came back. He was released from North Korea. He was on his knees, and he was declaring the crimes of the Kim Jong-il's regime.
Yeah.
The horrific. He was describing in detail what was going on in the gulags there. Georgianne, there are some gulags that are 10 miles wide, 20 miles long.
Yes.
With up to a million in some of it. It's just, it's worse than Auschwitz. And when
yes.
they do satanic rituals, human experimentation, there's no regard for humanity. He was describing this in front of the South Korea, who take kind of a passive role.
Yeah.
They don't want to stir up things.
Yeah.
You know, they're our brothers, let's just accept them who they are. No way. And he's on his knees, and he has a picture. He has a picture of a child that is just skin and bones, starving to death. And he says, there are hundreds of thousands like this, and he showed a picture of Kim Jong-il, and he reported his crimes and why his regime needs to come down. And he held up the two pictures, and he looked at all those South Koreans, and he's on his knees, and they're all around there with their cameras. Who do you choose?
Yeah.
Who do you choose? Kim Jong-il or this starving child? What are you going to do about it? And he is crying out with great anguish.
Yes.
And he takes the picture of Kim Jong-il and he smashes it on the sidewalk. He says, down with this, you know, this tyrant, this murderer, this criminal. I choose this child. And that's on a video.
Yes.
I mean, this is someone who was speaking like a prophet.
Yes.
I mean, he was there crying out in the streets just like you see the prophets in the Old Testament. He is like a modern-day prophet. And if God opens the door for him to be on the Bite Show, then we want to give him a voice.
Absolutely. I welcome it.
Yes.
I welcome him.
Yes.
Oh, I'm very emotional about the North Korean issue.
Yes.
When we point to evil, we point to Nazi Germany, the camps, and indeed, evil things were done.
Yes.
But today, the camps in North Korea, it is an abomination. It's a horror.
Yes.
And people must realize, if they think Nazi Germany was evil, was bad, we have today, as we speak, as you hear this message, we have the same and worse in North Korea.
That's right. That's absolutely true. Yes. Well, if we get Robert on it, we're going to give him an opportunity to describe the situation, the situation in South Korea, where many of the refugees are there and they have great needs that have come out of North Korea, their needs, what the church needs, what he would like to say to the church in the West.
Yes.
Allow him to speak and give him a voice.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
It'll be hard for him. I believe that he will break down, and we will just have to let it happen.
Yes.
Because it's okay. I mean, in view of what he's been through, that'll just validate. It'll just validate the reality and the importance of and I see this as really like a mission.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to giving him a voice.
Yes, I do too.
Everybody, please, next Saturday, Douglas is going to have a round table, and then the following week, we hope to have Robert Park on. Please watch for and listen to these programs. You will be amazed, totally amazed. Douglas, thank you, and God bless you and your anointing. Oh, my. And this ends the veil of spiritual death over the nations. Go to the Bite Show. Go to the audio library. Click on Douglas Riggs' name, and his page will open up, and all of the audio files are free. God bless everyone that's listening. Good night.